I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another one of our Urbanite Conversations. This comes from our keynote. This is the keynote in the issue we're talking about today, and we're about to talk with Ted Howard, who is Executive Director of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland. And Ted, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Mark. I'm pleased to be here.
So this is, and we met a bunch of months back when you addressed the Singapore group, you and Gaur Alperovitz did, to talk about your work in Cleveland, which I really want to talk about. So folks in the area who are listening, who stay tuned for this, because we're about to talk about something incredible that you're working on in Cleveland that really has implications for Baltimore, for Frederick, for Cumberland, for any city you can name. And we'll get into that in just a minute. So it's maybe one way to put people back to work and grow our communities. We're going to find out about that. But Ted, first of all, tell us a bit. Talk to me about the Democracy Collaborative.
We were founded about 10 years ago. We're based at the University of Maryland down in College Park. And our interest really is how do you strengthen democracy at the community level? And in neighborhoods and cities around America, and frankly, we're very concerned about the future of our democracy, particularly because of the growing wealth inequality in the United States. Political theorists of left and right disagree on most things, but one thing they agree on is when you get such concentrations of wealth as the kind that we're seeing in this country now, it becomes seriously eroding of democratic life. And so we're, as a democratic question, we're interested in how do you expand wealth and wealth-building opportunities for the tens of millions of Americans in low and moderate-income communities who've been left out of the American promise. And we're very interested in this idea of how do you create jobs, the kind that stay rooted somewhere, that don't get up and leave, like so many jobs are leaving in this globalizing and capital mobility era, and really rebuild the economies of some of our great cities, Baltimore being one.
I mean, no matter what major urban area you are part of or go to or hear from in this country, there's this huge dislocation in all those communities because of the deindustrialization and increased poverty that led to all the other things that we face. I mean, this is a common American theme, I think.
It certainly is. Things have gotten much worse, obviously, in the Great Recession that we're living through. But in so many of our cities, particularly our older industrial cities, not limited to them, but the scores of older industrial cities that had a strong manufacturing base once upon a time, you find in neighborhoods in Cleveland right now where we're doing some work, unemployment is over 25%, and it's probably considerably higher than that. And it's been over 25% even before the current recession. You've got the leak of population and jobs. And in a sense, our policy in this country has almost been a kind of a throwaway city policy. You know, these great urban areas with terrific infrastructure and extraordinary cultural and historical assets that are a legacy of their strong past industrial strength, now they're just sort of being thrown away. Let's all move somewhere else. And I don't think our country can afford to throw away our great cities nor the people in them.
Well, let's talk about what the focus of the work of the Democracy Collaborative in this very real way is centered around in Cleveland.
Yeah, that's correct. It's a little odd in some ways that the University of Maryland, where we're based, is doing a tremendous amount of work in Cleveland, Ohio. But what occurred 3 or 4 years ago was the Community Foundation here, which is the Cleveland Foundation. It's the oldest community foundation in the country, by the way. They contacted us and said, look, we need to rebuild our local economy. We need to put people to work. We need a economic strategy that creates jobs and wealth opportunities for our citizens. And they had followed our work, and they asked us to help them develop a strategy, to think through a strategy of how would you do this? What's a new model of economic development in urban areas? Because the model to date has been very much offer lots of incentives, and many people call them bribes, to large corporations, to come into a city to bring jobs for a few years. Often they're not very high-paying jobs. but the city kind of gives away their keys to the city to get the company in. Or it's been workforce development programs where we train people for jobs, but there are no jobs at the end of the pipeline. So people go through a big effort. They really try to improve themselves, and at the end of the day, they still can't get work. And so our task was, how do we actually create jobs that are meaningful, that are good living wage jobs, that have benefits, wealth-building opportunities, and how do we anchor them and locate them in some of the poorest and highest unemployment areas of the city? And for the last 3 years, that's what we've been doing. And some of your readers, listeners, may have seen that there's been a lot of reporting on this in The Economist and Nation Magazine and Business Week and so forth. And what's being fashioned here in Cleveland is something important, and it's becoming known as the Cleveland model. And we think it has great replication opportunities and possibilities, too.
Let's talk about this model. One of the things, the way I first heard about it was when you and Gaur Alberfitz spoke to a group of people here in Baltimore last year. And one of the things you're doing in Cleveland, you talked about the Evergreen Cooperative Laundry. That was a pretty amazing story, given that the anchor for the story is a hospital. And if anything, Baltimore is anchored by hospitals on both sides of town. Give us the story about this Evergreen Cooperative Laundry that is a worker-owned facility and what has happened here.
Well, the Evergreen Cooperative Laundry, as you said, is cooperatively owned by the people who work in it. In other words, it's a worker co-op. And this company, and it's one of a number of companies that we're starting, again, in low-income communities. There's another one called Ohio Cooperative Solar. There's a large food production greenhouse called the Green City Growers. They all share a certain design in common, and this is the design. First, they attach themselves to the procurement opportunities that come through the big anchor institutions in cities like Baltimore and Cleveland. By that, I mean big nonprofit institutions like universities, hospitals, cultural institutions, and the like. These kinds of big facilities are called anchors because, unlike major corporations, they don't get up and leave. You know, Johns Hopkins is going to be where it is in Baltimore, in 100 years. It's not going to move its whole campus over to, China. Mm-hmm. So they're anchored in place. And we tend to think of these institutions as, educational or health. But they're also very much big businesses. And here in Cleveland, just three of the largest institutions, the Cleveland Clinic, University Hospitals, and Case Western Reserve University, annually spend $3 billion on goods and services. Almost none of that spending, however, is done locally. And so this project is designed to capture some of that spending, drive it into the community, then link it to the buildup of new small businesses that are employing 50 to 100 people, that are cooperatively owned, and that are green. All of the Evergreen businesses, they're called, are the greenest businesses in their sector. And that's the design of the laundry, which is, you tend to think of a laundry, you think maybe of a very small dry cleaning facility. This is an industrial commercial scale laundry doing 10 to 12 million pounds of healthcare bed linen for hospitals and nursing homes, about a $6 million operation a year, and it will employ 50 people when fully operating, all of whom will be the owners of the laundry. There will be no outside investors. It's all owned internally.
So let's back up and talk about a few things here. If you go back in modern history, one of the things that struck me as a younger man when I was a student in the Spanish Civil War was the Madragon cooperatives, which is still an ongoing industry owned by workers in Spain that survived. Is this a model for that? And if it is, talk about that and the connection to that philosophically.
Yes, the Madragon Cooperative Corporation, it's called, is something that's greatly influencing what we're doing here in Cleveland. In a nutshell, here's the story. In 1956, three or four workers and a Catholic priest got together and said, our region, which has been oppressed for so long by General Franco, who, of course, was the fascist dictator at the time. We've got to do something for ourselves because our government's not going to help us. In fact, it's repressing us. So these four or five individuals got together and said, let's start a company, and we'll make it a cooperatively owned company, and we'll manufacture little stoves for heating, and the profits will be ours. So we'll get some, you know, assets that we can move forward on. From that humble beginning, 50 years later, there are now 120 Mondragon cooperatives, all linked together. 87 of them are industrial cooperatives. They employ over 100,000 workers who are owners of the companies. They are the seventh largest industrial group in all of Spain, and their bank, which is known as the Caja Laboral, is the third largest bank in Spain. Last year, they did something on the order of $20 billion in sales, and it's a highly democratic model, fully participatory in the workplace, and again, owned by the workers themselves. And we think that this model, properly adapted to the American situation, can be part of a winning formula for job creation in urban areas today.
Now, but one of the things you just said, people will have argument with, is that the idea that you can run a business on a democratic basis, that businesses, the way we look at them, are structured in a very hierarchical way, top down, making decisions, and that this model of democracy inside business is one that would really be, in many people's minds, obstructionist, that it would get in the way of progress, the get away of getting things done, because you have to talk through everything with every worker, that it's not a viable model. So respond to that.
Well, you know, that is a very common thought. You know, we're so used to checking our democratic rights at the door when we enter the workplace and working for somebody and being told what to do. It's almost hard to conceive that you can actually have democracy, not just politically, but economically at the workplace. In fact, there are worker cooperatives all across the country that are very successful, and there's another mechanism called the Employee Stock Ownership Plan, otherwise known as an ESOP, where you've got really almost 10,000 companies in America that have significant worker ownership, and some of them are highly democratic. You know, the studies, you know, I'm at a university, so I look at academic studies, and there have been some serious academic studies of both worker co-ops and employee-owned firms, which show that, in fact, far from being inefficient due to democracy at the workplace, they are more productive than similar companies doing the same thing in their sector but that aren't employee-owned. They tend to retain their employees longer, so they're more profitable, and they lead to greater asset accumulation because the employees have a stake in the company. So, you know, it's sort of the quick top-of-the-mind thing is, well, this can't possibly work.
Right.
But in fact, it does, and it's been demonstrated to work.
So the way these things work, I mean, so to talk a bit about how in this Evergreen Cooperative Laundry in Cleveland, a $6 million facility that was built, how that literally works. You have 50 workers. Their contract is with the hospital, correct?
Yeah, with the hospital and with the number of nursing homes.
And so tell me, how does that co-op function? I mean, people go to do their jobs every day. Your job may be to press. Your job may be to clean. Your job may be to deliver and pick up. So how does the rest work?
Well, the model is this. And, you know, let me be quite transparent and say, you know, this first company was officially opened last October. So mm-hmm. we're still, you know, working out the kinks, and we're still learning as we go. But the model is this, that when you're hired first as a temporary worker for about a six-month period. And during that time, you're judged on how good a team player you are. Are you showing up to work? You know, all the kinds of things. You're getting performance reviews. At the end of that period, you're invited to join the cooperative and become a member of the co-op. What that means is you immediately get a raise of a couple dollars an hour, which is more than the competitors pay, by the way. And from your salary, 50 cents every hour is deducted and put into your account in your over a three-year period in the firm, so that at the end of 3 years, you've invested $3,000 of your own money that that's your money that stays in the company. That's your share of the company. Then over time, as the company is profitable, each year it turns a profit, dividends are allocated to everyone's account. And the projections are from our business plan, which we think is quite conservative, that at the end of 8 years as an employee, you will have a $65,000 ownership stake in the company, which is your money. When you leave, you can take that with you, and it continues to grow beyond the $65,000. So that's how that piece works. The other piece is, you're playing two roles when you're at the company. When you're on the line doing the laundry, you've got your worker hat on. You know, you've got to run the machines. You've got to do a job. But then at certain times, you put your owner hat on. And those times are, for instance, every month, the whole company gets together, and there's open book financial management. You look at your income, your profit and loss. You start to make decisions on, is it time for us to get a raise? If we do get a raise, what happens to the capital of the company? Maybe it's better to defer that. So you are literally making the democratic decisions in the company, and you're doing it together. This doesn't happen instantly. People need to be trained, and we're building a culture of ownership in the company, because it's very different than just clocking in at 9 and leaving at 5. This is now your company. Your livelihood is dependent on making this work. But so far, we're finding that the model's working very well indeed.
So I think it's a model that is almost antithetical to what most people think of American business, which is why it's so important to hear how this is working and kind of explore it through the eyes of the workers as well, maybe, which we can do another time. The Evergreen Cooperative Laundry, it costs $6 million to build a facility. Is that right?
$5.7 million, yeah.
So where does that money come from? Who supports a cooperative industry like this?
Right. Well, this is really to the credit, first and foremost, of the local philanthropy here in the form of the Cleveland Foundation. The foundation said the following. We've got to create jobs in this community. We've got to find a new strategy. And so they took a risk, and they said, we're going to put $3 million into a fund to help seed a group of companies that can start to employ people locally. Of that $3 million, we took $750,000, and we dedicated it to the Evergreen Cooperative Laundry. With that $750,000, we then leveraged an additional $5 million, and it came in the form of money from Housing and Urban Development. The technical name is HUD 108 dollars, a long-term 20-year low-interest loan. And that money came through the City of Cleveland, which is a big supporter of this strategy. We got a couple conventional bank loans. We put in something called a new market tax credit, which is a complicated financial deal, but is a way to get equity into a firm. And so we have a leadership team of a number of people that represent my group, the Democracy Collaborative, the Cleveland Foundation, community group, Shore Bank, which is the community development bank, and the like. And we put these deals together. The greenhouse deal, which is a 5-acre underglass urban fruit production greenhouse, the largest urban greenhouse in the country. It will grow 800,000 heads of lettuce on each acre of hydroponics. So that's 4 million heads of lettuce. To open that greenhouse, which we're about to break ground on, will cost $14 million.
$14 million?
$14 million. And where we got that was about $1 million of grant money. We got $1 million of the stimulus bill, the famous ARRA stimulus bill. This, I can say, at least $1 million of it is being well used because we got a grant from the Department of Energy that's going to allow us to erect a 250-foot-tall 1.5-megawatt wind turbine in the heart of the city to help generate power for this. And then, again, state funds, which originally came from the feds and the federal government, of $10 million for brownfield redevelopment are going into this deal. So what we found is that part of this model is the creative use of local philanthropic dollars. If this was in Baltimore, you might think of the Abel Foundation, the Casey Foundation, the Goldsecker Foundation, and others. The creative use of the philanthropic dollars, which is the lowest cost capital, can be used to leverage and access sources of money that don't generally make it their way into the low-income community. And that's part of the formula here.
So it's a the question of money and how we invest our money becomes a big part of whether or not worker-owned cooperatives, worker-owned industries can actually work in a community. I mean, you've got to change in some ways, it seems to me, the way banks and the way other institutions invest their money.
Well, that's exactly right. Now, they're, you know, the companies that we're building, because, again, they're designed to meet the need of goods and services for these large institutions like the Cleveland Clinic and so forth, they're high capital businesses. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that getting $6 million for a laundry or $14 million for a greenhouse, that that's easy to do. That's hard work. There are other lower cost capital forms of cooperative ownership out in the Bay Area, San Francisco. There's a cooperative house cleaning group with, I think, about 50 or 100 women in it. It's called Wages. And you don't need much money up front to do that. There's a home care cooperative with 1,200 worker owners in New York City and Brooklyn. You don't need much to put that together, but you do need to find money. And, you know, frankly, there's all this talk about, you know, now that the banks are lending again. Well, in our experience, they're really not. So we're using very little bank money. We're finding other sources of money.
And they're all nonprofit foundation sources? Where else would the money come from?
Well, there's the nonprofits in the form of either, you know, the grants from the foundations or the program-related investments, which are very low-interest loans, like 2% interest loans, so very low-cost capital. But then, as I said, what we've done is then use that money to go out and access money from federal sources, state sources, city government sources. The other thing is we've gotten investments from the anchor institution. We started a company called Ohio Cooperative Solar, which is doing large 100-kilowatt solar panel installations on the large flat roofs of the hospitals and the universities here. So, and we own the panels, and the university or the hospital buys the energy from it. But to get that company going, the three large institutions each put $250,000 into the pot to help start the company because they thought it was a good way for them to begin to diversify their energy sources and become greener.
So two things. I mean, so then do these nonprofit institutions like universities and hospitals that would invest, let's say, in the Ohio Cooperative Solar Company, cooperative, A, do they get their money back as an investor? And B, are their costs then lower for their electricity?
In response to your question, A, they do not get their money back. This is, in a sense, a one-time grant to help capitalize the company. B, over time, they will get lower energy costs. As you know, it's difficult to compete with the energy companies right now with solar, both in terms of the actual cost per kilowatt. But what we've been able to do is form a 15-year contract with the institution, what we call a power purchase agreement. And we set the cost of energy at a flat rate for the 15 years. Right now, they will be paying a few cents more than they could from the utility company. But they're betting that over the 15 years, the cost of energy is going to keep going up. And at one time, you know, the graph will cross over and that buying energy from Ohio Cooperative Solar will actually be cheaper than it will be from the public utility company or the private utility company.
So here you have the Evergreen Cooperative Laundry.
Yep.
You've got in Cleveland, you've got the Ohio Cooperative Solar.
Yes.
And you have got the Evergreen City Growers.
Right.
Right? Three worker-owned industries. Now, I wonder, that hire how many people at the moment?
At the moment, well, the greenhouse is yet to break ground, so we only have a couple people that are developing it. We have probably between the laundry's got, you know, 10 to 15 people. It'll eventually hit 50. The Ohio Cooperative Solar, I think, is about 15 right now. It will eventually hit 100 employees. So we're ramping up the scale as we go.
All right. So let's take a look at Cleveland. Let's think about other urban areas and what this might mean and how it gets there. I mean, you're talking about creating worker-owned industries, so the workers are invested in it. They're not just workers. They're owners. They put more time in. They get something back out of it as well. They're invested in this company. They have retirement. They have health care. They have a salary. Large institutions are purchasing these services from them. But we know that you've just mentioned maybe Eastern Industries maybe will employ 150 people, maybe 200, who knows.
Right.
But there are tens of thousands of people, black, Latino, Indian, white, who are living in poverty in our cities and out of work. And you said Cleveland 25% unemployment, maybe in Baltimore it's the same in inner cities. And you said also that the institutions in Cleveland, like Wayne State University and these hospitals, spend $3 billion in goods and services, is what you said at the beginning of our conversation.
Right.
So how does this thing grow? I mean, is this something that remains small because it's the nature of it and it can't grow? Or is it actually there's something possible with this $3 billion being spent by local anchor institutions can actually begin to flow into workers' co-ops that put people to work? And tell me what you think can happen.
Our vision is that this is enormously expansive, the possibility. There is a huge market that's available through these local large institutions if we can focus their purchasing locally and if we can bring them on as partners. And here in Cleveland, by the way, with the institutions, they are full partners. And in fact, one of the things they're doing now is reassessing their supply chains from top to bottom to find out, you know, our hospital, what kinds of goods and services are we buying? Are these local vendors, if they are based locally, are they owned locally, or are they owned by a multinational corporation that's headquartered in some other state,
mm-hmm.
and therefore all the money's being sucked down? Our sense is, our target in the next 3 years is to get to 500 jobs in the inner city here. And bear in mind, there are no other jobs being created. So, however, the neighborhoods we're working in have 43,000 residents with an median household income below $18,500. So 500 jobs is insufficient. The larger vision we have is over this next 10 to 15 years, can we create 5 or even 10,000 jobs through this strategy? And I think we can. And in fact, I think that this strategy can be sort of disseminated throughout the state of Ohio. One of the big challenges is going to be to move beyond service industries, which is what we're in now, to start to rebuild some of the manufacturing base of the state. And we're starting to look at manufacturing opportunities. But we have 2 or 3 other companies in the pipeline that are going through research and development. And our goal is to have 2 or 3 new companies moving through the pipeline every year as we continue to expand the network, as they have in Mondragon, you know, to get from that one small company to 120 cooperatives employing 100,000 people.
So what do you think this means, not just economically for America and our cities, but what you are saying politically this means and socially?
There are a couple things going on in this country. One, I think the level of pain in our urban areas among low and moderate income people is so extraordinarily high that unless we're just going to write off, you know, 30 or 40 million Americans and say we're going to go forward without them, we've got to find some new approaches. Second, I think that among lots of us who've been working in economic development for a long time, there's a growing sense that the approaches we've been using just have hit a dead end. You know, we've got to get outside of this box we're in toward a new strategy. And, you know, broadening ownership of capital, I think, is a winning formula. It's not the only answer, but it's a winning formula for helping to expand the assets of individuals at work and also to anchor these companies in localities. Because, you know, if you and I and your listeners all owned a company together in Baltimore and we lived near the company and went to work, there's no way we'd vote to send our jobs overseas. We'd keep them where we are. So, you know, I mean, it could be labeled socialist. It could be labeled, you know, some people say you're trying to make everybody a capitalist by giving them an ownership stake. I don't know what the right label is, but I do feel that creating jobs and ownership opportunities, which is what the mayor of Cleveland's talking about, that's his commitment. that's something that, you know, is entirely viable. And, you know, one thing, not to ramble, but one other thing to say, it's very interesting. My colleagues and I wrote an article on The Nation magazine, which is a very progressive magazine. It came out on a Thursday a couple weeks ago, talking about this strategy and its implications. The very next day on Friday, there was a very long and extremely favorable article about the Cleveland model and Evergreen in Business Week. And I talked to the Business Week reporter, and he was kind of laughing. He said, you know, when's the last time that The Nation magazine and Business Week ever agreed on anything? And I think there's something here that makes sense to people. It crosses some sort of divide. Not that we won't run into opposition, but I just think it makes sense.
These are the kind of things that cross the divide that people have to start thinking about. And I quote, my own impatient way when I hear these things, I said, I wish there was a way the thing could move much quicker than it does to get more people to work and really kind of deal with the issues that we face in our urban areas, you know. I guess we'll have to keep pushing.
Well, you know, when you look at our great cities like Cleveland, you know, I'm more familiar with that than Baltimore. But, you know, Cleveland in the 1950s was home to more Fortune 500 corporations. They were headquartered in Cleveland. Than any city in the United States outside of New York City. And over the last number of decades, that's degraded where basically it's all gone away. So while I would like to get our results going faster, and God knows with the level of pain and distress in our communities, you know, we need tens, hundreds of thousands of jobs being created every year. On the other hand, if you look at it, it's taken decades for our cities to get in this terrible shape, and it's going to take a long rebuilding process to get out. But, you know, I'm hopeful that if we stand 10 or 15 years and look back, that in places like Cleveland and I think in Baltimore, we can make some real significant concrete progress in this next 10 or 15 years. And if successful, we can fashion a model that can really give hope and inspiration to people and hopefully change federal policy about our urban areas and how we deal with them.
Ted Howard, Executive Director of the Democracy Collaborative. It's been fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538.